Welcome to the Savvy Dentist Podcast with Dr. Jesse Green, the show where great dentistry meets great business. Listen in each week as we bring you an inspiring person who will share their story, ideas, and business techniques to help you create a practice and a life you love. And now introducing your host, Dr. Jesse Green.
Welcome back to the Savvy Dentist Podcast, the show where great dentistry happily collides with great business so that you can create a practice and a life that you really love. It's Jesse Green here at the control panels as always. And before we get into this week's interview with our guest, Jenny Litz, I've just got a couple of quick announcements I wanted to make with you. And for people who have not yet heard, I wanted to let you know that we have officially launched the Savvy Dentist app. So you can head across to the App Store or to the Google Play Store and download the Savvy Dentist app. It's available obviously on iOS and Android. And that app is going to give you the latest in terms of podcasts, in terms of blogs. And we've got a whole lot more stuff that we're going to be adding to that as well. So please head across to the App Store of your choice and grab a copy of that particular app. It's a cracker. And we're really, really proud of it. It's taken an inordinate amount of work to get that done. And we're really pleased to be able to bring that to you. And of course, it's a free app. In addition to that, you might want to head across to the Savvy Dentist Facebook group where we have tools and training and tips and so on and so forth so that you can create a practice that really rocks. One that is going to give you a life that's really enjoyable, one that's going to give you everything you need from your business and is going to help you on that journey of becoming a great business owner, transitioning from operatorship to ownership. And that's really what we're all about here at Savvy Dentist. Now, our guest today is very, very clever. She is one of the smartest business people I know. Jenny Litz is a forensic accountant, and she is an expert witness in many court cases that involve either marital issues or indeed commercial litigation. And her particular expertise is around the valuation of businesses. And she's been doing this for nearly 20 years, and she's valued literally thousands and thousands of businesses, including many, many dental practices over the years. And so what we're going to be talking to Jenny about today is really about the different types of valuation methods, and specifically what are the factors that affect the value of a business. And Jenny's going to share some terrific IP around that, and I'm going to encourage you, to make sure you take some great notes, because everything that she's going through in this conversation is directly applicable to you and your business. And really, ultimately, what we're all trying to do with our business is to create value, to add value and to create value. And Jenny's got some wonderful insights, some wonderful wisdom that she's going to share so that you can do just that indeed. So I really hope you enjoy this interview with Jenny Litz. Her website is jennyletz.com.au. I'd really encourage you to go and check out her stuff. She's got some really wonderful material there. And as always, as I mentioned earlier, have a pen and paper handy, because I know you're going to get some terrific stuff to take back to your practice first thing Monday morning. But without any further ado, here's Jenny Litz. Jenny, welcome to our podcast. It's wonderful to have you here.
Hi, Jesse. It's lovely to be here.
Fantastic. Well, Jen, you know, we've been catching up a lot of times now. One of the things that I've always been fascinated with your work, whether it's valuations or forensics, is the intricate knowledge you have of numbers, the ability to read the patterns to be able to make informed decisions based on those numbers. So before we dive into the work that you do, I'm just wondering, can you let our audience know a little bit about your background? Because valuations and forensics sounds a little bit CSI-like, and I'm just curious to understand how you found your way into that kind of work.
Technically, I'm called a forensic accountant, and inside of that, I niche into business valuations. And inside of that, I niche into valuing goodwill, basically. I value goodwill. We do also brand, systems and processes, intellectual property. I value that. We value royalties and patents. So basically, I explain it to my family as it's all the stuff you can't touch is what we do. It's an interesting area. Oddly, whilst they call me an accountant, I have never completed a tax return. I tried right back at the beginning and I failed miserably. There are so many boxes that things have to go in, and you need to know that computer system, and I was terrible at it. And they quickly took me out of that and put me back into forensics, where I was quite happy. I think for me, forensics is, I fell into it very early on. So my degree, I was studying to be a derivatives trader. So I was studying banking, finance, risk management, and somebody said, tack on an accounting major so you can read financial statements. I thought, that's a good idea, so I'll do that. And my first semester, I met a girl in my accounting class, and she said there was a job going in her firm. I thought I could never, ever, ever work in that. That would be way beyond what I could possibly do. It was summarizing financial statements. And that was when I was 17, and I'm still here.
Wow.
So I'm still doing the same job.
Wow, isn't that amazing?
But it fulfills all the needs that I have. So I'm very, very lucky. I love the problem solving. I was one of those strange kids who loved algebra. I just loved it. There was always a definite answer, so I loved that. As opposed to English and history, where you could write so many different versions, although part of my job is I work as a court expert for a lot of my work, probably about 85-90% of my work is appearing as an expert witness in court. So we have to turn the numbers, solve the problem, and then turn that into words so that the barristers and the judge and everybody else in the courtroom can understand. It has taken me to very strange places. We learn a lot about how to hide money and where it goes and trace it all around the world. Although I've stepped a little bit away from fraud now. Fraud's very exciting. We read about it in the newspapers. But once you've found it, somebody's got to go and add it up. And I find that quite boring. I like the finding of it.
You're like the sleuth, aren't you? You're the super sleuth.
I love that part. I love that part. It solves a lot of my needs out of a business. I get to solve problems every day. I get to work on projects. So no 2 days are ever the same. And even though I have valued, I think at last count, it's over 1,500 matters that I've worked on now. So within that, there's usually more than one business. Sometimes there's 8, sometimes there's 20. Property developers have about 45. So there's lots of businesses I've valued, and not two of them are ever the same. They're always different.
There's thousands of businesses in those 1,500 matters, isn't there? There's heaps and heaps and heaps. So let's talk a bit about that, Jenny, because, you know, as you say, you're an expert witness, you appear in court. I imagine a lot of the work you do would be some family law situations as well as the commercial dispute space and so on. So I wanted to ask you, when it comes to the work that you do, putting a number on a business or an element of a business, one of the things that we've found in dentistry is it's been a little tricky to find a methodology, a standard way of doing things, because sales data isn't always available. So I'm curious to understand, in the absence of loads and loads and loads and loads of sales, is there a methodology? How do you go about doing that? What's the secret sauce? What do you do to come to that number? Because I think, like you said earlier, you like the definiteness of definiteness. Mm. Is that a word?
Did definitiveness.
Thank you. I don't know if I made that word up. You heard it here first, folks. But we like a black and white answer. We like a point estimate as compared to this whole waffly narrative. So I'm curious to ask, how do you arrive at value?
I'm completely with you there. It has to have a proper value. And look, in saying that, we do have to round off some figures because so part of my degree was forecasting, and there are certain assumptions we need to make about what's going to happen in the future. And we use a lot of our experience to measure those areas of risk, but there is an element of that. So getting right down to the nitty gritty, and I hope your listeners don't fall asleep with this.
Not at all. I can tell you now, they're going to be taking notes now. There'll probably be some out with their calculators as we go through this, I guarantee it. I can almost hear the adding machines going.
There's a couple of different methodologies that we can use. And in an ideal world, if all your assumptions are pretty reasonable, whichever methodology you use, you should come up with the same value. So the reason we use different methodologies is some of them are a bit more appropriate in certain circumstances. And it may come down to the documents that are available. I know a lot of industries talk about a rule of thumb, and we really don't use that when we're providing values in court and when we're doing calculations on those sorts of things. If I can jump out of Australia for a moment and we talk about the United States, so when businesses are bought and sold in the United States, they keep a record of what those sales were, similar to what we do in the real estate industry here. So you can almost benchmark your business against other businesses, similar to what we do with houses here. You know, if the one next door sold for $500,000 and you go, well, my house is a bit bigger, my block is a little bit bigger, I'm thinking we might get $550 for it. And that's a fairly reasonable how they benchmark. And when you, I don't know if you've had the opportunity to ever read a property valuer's report, but that's generally what they do.
I studied property val, Jen.
Oh, did you? I didn't know that.
Yeah, there you go.
Yeah. So that's what they tend to do, that benchmarking. I don't do that myself. We may do it as a bit of a reasonableness check, but we tend to use a mix of mainly sort of three methodologies. The first one is what they call a CAPM and a WAC. It's an exciting name, a WACC. And that's when, particularly around share trading, if you're valuing anything where there is a business that is on the stock market, we can use elements of that. So there is data that we can get, and I subscribe to some of that, where we can see how those businesses that are on the stock market move in comparison with the entire stock market. And that's called a beta. So we can pull that and then we can build out from there. But you still have to understand elements of risk for the individual business. Let me jump out of that methodology and into the other two that we use a bit more commonly for small to medium sized businesses. The first methodology that we use quite a bit is called a maintainable earnings, or a capitalization of maintainable earnings. We use that when we have historical data. So the other method is a discounted cash flow. And at times we jump into our own jargon there and we call that a DCF. Now, we use a discounted cash flow generally when a company, or I should say a business, operates with very good budgets. Basically, it's forecasting forward. We also value startup businesses with that as well too. And also, if we have businesses that have a defined timeline, so you might have a business that's only going to last, I'm thinking of maybe a quarry or something where they've got another 5 years to run, they've got this many diamonds that they can mine, and that's it. So we can value it based on that. And it's discounted cash flow is taking forward cash flow and bringing them back to today's date.
So to get a net present value, right?
Exactly, a net present value. Would you like me to delve deeper into this maintainable earnings?
I would love, because I think that's the thing. That seems to be the key, because the audience listening, I guarantee, as they're driving to work at the moment in their car, they're thinking maintainable earnings is going to be key, because that's going to provide the cash flow for the business to fund itself. So I'd love to hear your thoughts around that.
Quite often, most small businesses don't pull together budgets, which leaves us with basically historical data. So we have these financial statements that we have going backwards. Now, we have to go through that and we try and work out. We go through and analyze all that data. We ask a lot of questions and we're going through. Our aim is to try and work out what this special maintainable earnings is, this future maintainable earnings. So that's the money that a business would earn. It's essentially a profit, but it's a normalized profit. There are a few rules around how we value businesses, how we come up with that. First one is, and I should start by saying, for every rule, there are exceptions. The same as when I was learning Italian and Latin and everything else. There's always an exception to every rule. But if you bear with me, generally, we value all businesses on an unencumbered basis. So if you have interest on a loan or something, we generally add that back. The reasoning behind that is to put everybody on an even keel. Some people have the money to buy in, other people have to have a loan. If you're trying to compare those together, you have to take the interest out. So we take out borrowing costs and interest, etc. The other thing we do is we then go through and we work out, these are sort of some of the simpler ones, any abnormal expenditure. So, you know, 1 year you might have to, for example, we've got this $20,000 write-off for instant write-off for assets at the moment. Because it's a temporary rule, we have to undo that and put that back in as if it were normal. We don't know when the government's going to actually take that off, but they keep telling us it's going to be soon. So to value that business, and if we're adding back elements of that depreciation, then that's going to increase your profit. It's same if you're adding back to the elements of the interest, it's going to increase the profit at the end of the day. We take away items for abnormal expenditure, sort of one-off things, things that aren't being incurred anymore. And we also take out elements of discretionary items. So somebody might like to have a really fancy car when really they don't need that fancy car to run around all over town to do their job. A big part of what we do as well too is working out what the duties and the roles of the person that owns the business does in it. So most small businesses, the person that runs it works in that business. And quite often, they don't pay themselves enough money. So it happens all the time.
All the time.
So we have to go through a workout, what duties they do, how many hours they do, etc. And then we have to try and, whilst we're not remuneration experts, we have to take our best guess. We have little disclaimers in there and that in our court report, because you can get remuneration experts, but not everyone wants to pay for that fee. But we try and work out what a commercial level of remuneration for that person would be. That's where it would be really helpful if, say, for your clients, if they're wanting to look at this at any point and moving forward, that they sort of pay themselves a little bit of a wage. Or I shouldn't say a little bit, if they can try and get their wage to what they'd have to pay for anybody else to be, like for your clients to be a dentist in that role. And then they may need to have, it may need to be increased because they're making big business decisions and things like that. So those sorts of things we always need to know so that we can get that right. The other thing is if people own their premises in their super fund, which a lot of my clients do, we need to make sure that that's a commercial rate that's being paid as well too for that.
Okay, so there's a lot that goes into figuring out the maintainable earnings, and there's a lot of adjustments that go through.
So that's just to get to the adjusted part. Then we need to work out if this business is in a growth phase, if it's stagnant or if it's dropping off or if it's fluctuating, so that we can work out what one figure is moving forward. Does that make sense?
It makes perfect sense.
Which is our future maintainable earnings.
Exactly. So clearly a business that's on a growth trajectory is going to be worth more than one that's in decline.
Yeah, well, if it's on a growth trajectory, then we don't want to take a straight average across, because that would be misleading. And it's not just sales. We look at all these other factors going through as well too. So gross profit and then expenses as well, and try and work it out from there.
Okay, Jenny, so we've taken into account earnings, we've taken into account the trajectory and so on. And you mentioned that ultimately one of the models you spoke about was a capitalization type model, the cap rate. So how, for one little number, there's a lot that goes into that little number. And so interestingly enough, you know, when I talk to different people there, and I won't mention names, but there's, as you mentioned, rules of thumb, 3.5 times earnings or, you know, whatever it happens to be. So what are the things that go into a cap rate? Obviously, there's going to be a risk assessment. There's going to be all those sorts of things. But what are the little bits of thinking that goes into determining the most appropriate cap rate?
So this is where I was taught, my mentor was very old school. And one of the reasons I changed and went with him was because I knew he was going to teach me how to do this from the ground up. And I'd worked for people that had taken a really good stab at it and had a really good guess, but I wanted that scientific methodology for it. So I wanted to know how that one answer that's right, or as right as we can possibly make it, as correct as we can possibly make it. So I use what we call a build-up method. Sounds fancy, doesn't it? Very simple. But well, I use a build-up method. So once we have this future maintainable earnings, we have to apply this capitalization rate. Now, I should say the other word that people know for this is a multiplier, and a capitalization rate is exactly the same thing. It's just the inverse.
Yep. Yeah. So, and I've spoken about a multiple and called it a capitalization rate a moment ago. So sorry about that, folks. That was me me using multipliers and cap rates, but it's the same thing as you say, inverse. So, yeah.
It is. So a cap rate of 25% is a multiplier of four.
Yep.
So it's quite easy. Once you get that straight in your head, as long as you know which one you're using, it's fine. A capitalization rate is basically what you're doing is going through that business and you're working out all the levels of risk that it has. So all the elements of risk, and then you're putting a level of risk on all of those. Now, to start, I can give you a bit of my IP here. I always start with the country. So the risk of the country that we're in. Now, that comes down to government bond rates. So how are they sitting? So then we go to work out what a general investor would want over and above putting their money into a government bond. Now, that information is a little bit hard to find, but it's publicly available. It's called the market risk premium, or an MRP. If you speak to any investment bankers, they should be able to tell you what that is. Basically, they take the stock market over a 40-year period and they say, how much does that move over and above the bond rate? And it usually sits somewhere between 6 and 7%. That gets added on. So all I'm doing here is building risk. After that, we put on a size premium because the businesses we're valuing are not the size of BHP. And if you're going to invest in a small business, you're going to want a bit more money than investing in one that's in the stock market. When you invest in the stock market, you've got all the beautiful built-in risk lowering systems of the liquidity and being able to pull your money in and out quite easily, plus all the information available as well to you. So those elements are just basically to get us to the point of we're a small business. Then we go through and we find the levels of risk for that particular industry that the business is in. And so I know yours is mainly, the people that you deal with are mainly dentists. However, for me, I deal with, done in the last week, I have valued a chrome plating business. I've valued a plastic surgeon. I have valued an aviary, many, many, many different businesses. So that's why I love my job. There's never 2 days alike. Now, so we start to look at that industry. And then after that, we get into what we call the business-specific risks. So there we're looking at all sorts of things. We're looking at elements of leverage, you know, how much loans does this, how many loans does this business have? What is that percentage looking like? What sort of loans are there? We're also looking at, okay, how does this business actually run? So this is where we ask a lot of questions around, tell me about your business. Tell me how. And I generally start this off as a bit of a conversation. And then whatever they say, I'm just pulling elements of that out. So do we have, you know, does this business have two customers? Are they signed up to contract? What happens if one customer goes? What's going on there? I've had businesses that pick fruit where 95% of what they sell is with one of the big supermarkets, but it's on a handshake. But it's been on a handshake for the last 15 years. So it's tricky, but what we're trying to do is work out where all these elements of risk are. Do they buy things from overseas? Is there a foreign exchange element? Are they in one spot or are they in many spots? All these different things. That business owner, how reliant are they on that one person? That's a big one. Is there key man insurance on that particular business owner? You know, are there systems and processes in place? I can tell you from experience of where I value businesses, where there are systems and processes in place, where there is a documented roles for people, their multipliers are very high.
So listen up, folks. There's a huge clue to increasing your own multiple there. Just listen up. You want to make sure you're de-risking your business. Jenny's just shared some absolute gems, some pearls of wisdom there. And we've spoken a bit about key person risk and making sure there's insurance in place around that person, but equally trying not to be overly reliant on that one person, making sure you've got documented structures in terms of roles and deliverables for each person on the team, and generally good, strong operational processes and systems in place. So, Jen, it sounds like that multiplier or the cap rate really is a reflection of risk predominantly. Is there other things that go into it beyond risk, or is it primarily risk?
It's primarily risk. We take inflation off there are times where we may take an element of growth off as well too, if we're talking about more like a sort of unicorn businesses that are scaling very high. Each one is a little bit different, and the questions that we ask are a little bit different for each business. But it's just trying to work out how it runs, you know, where it gets its sales from, and what's going to affect the customers that come through that business. So if we were talking about like Louis Vuitton, well, if we were to, and touch wood, fall into a recession and say all the super rich people in the world, their money were all to disappear out of the banks, well, then Louis Vuitton is really going to jump down in value, because nobody's going to be able to afford to buy from them because they hit for that particular market.
Okay, so just taking this back to dentistry for a moment, because in any economic climate, whether it's a favourable one or a fairly neutral one, or indeed one that's, you know, in recession, there are certain things that business owners can be doing to mitigate risk in their business. And you've had the opportunity to work with lots of businesses over the years. And I imagine, Jen, there'll be times when you've valued a business today, and then a few years later or some period of time later, you've valued them again and they've hopefully increased in value, but perhaps not. But what I'm trying to extract from you is, for the audience members listening here, and because I think this is really important, is one of the things we talk about, Jen, is creating such a hierarchy of needs, you know, firstly profitable, so there's good cash flow going through the business, then something that's, you know, scalable, so that there's more time available for the business owner, de-risking through leverage and systems and team and all those sorts of things. And then, of course, creating value in the business as well. So I wanted to ask specifically, what things could drive that value beyond, I mean, yes, we're talking about the multiplier. So we could look at the earnings, obviously. We could look at making sure we're driving revenue, managing cash, all those sorts of things. We can look at the multiple. Is there anything else in there that business owners should really drill down into, in your experience, to go, okay, if I want to sell my business in 5 years' time, and then reverse engineer back from that, if they know what their sale price is, what sort of things should they be considering now if they wanted to sell their business for a certain amount of money?
So things I'd probably recommend are, get your profit stable. That would be a big one, first of all. Generally, when we're valuing these businesses, we're looking back. I look back 5 years. Since the GFC came through, I always ask for 5 years worth of financial statements. That's another point. Make sure your financial statements are good. If it is, and I hope that the ATO is not listening, but if there are certain elements that are run through for tax minimization purposes, that somehow they are identified, that you can pull those out, because they may be personal elements to those. And if you have that in a way that you can identify those for a buyer, that maybe if somebody else were to buy your business, they wouldn't have those, that would be very helpful as well. I would try and ensure that the staff that you're paying, including yourself, if you're working in the business, try and get that to a commercial level. And then, so that's just for your profitability. Then I'd be looking at working through all your multiplier stuff, so de-risking that business. So that's your systems and processes, documenting roles, documenting what people do, have it so that maybe more than one person in the office knows how to do more than one thing, so other people can step in to those roles if necessary, so that sometimes we have businesses that have a high staff turnover. Well, we can de-risk that by having folders for each person that say, well, sorry, not each person, each role, saying this is what they do. Having training there that they can go and look that up. That would be really helpful, because that's going to minimize the amount of time that it takes for a new person to get up to speed. And if I were buying into a business, if we had all of that, that's really valuable. And therefore, the price tends to go up. And that's what will bump up your multiplier as well. Because I tend to work a lot in matrimonial and shareholder disputes and litigation disputes, etc., I take it a step further. At least one step further. What we do is we go through and work out what assets are used to derive that business. And if there's anything left over at the end of the day, that's our goodwill. So my point there would be, make sure that you keep your trade debtors down, because that's an asset. So we, as an asset, when we get this value of the business, and let's say we've got a value of a business of $1 million and we have trade debtors there of 250,000, so we've got receivables that we haven't brought back in, then we have to take that off. We also have to take off the plant and equipment as well too, and what that's valued at. So we're trying to, if at the end of the day, what you get to keep tends to be this element of goodwill in that, so that it hasn't cost you anything other than your time to build this business, and, well, obviously that's cost you a lot.
Just a minor point.
I can't say it like that.
No, well, it does, because it's, you know, and to be candid, it's not necessarily everyone's cup of tea, but for those who are in that, it does cost you a lot in terms of time, effort and energy.
A lot in terms of time, effort and energy, that's right. And it's just not maybe a dollar value put on it until right at that end point, which is the goodwill that you get out of that at the end.
Lovely. So, Jen, thank you. That is a super comprehensive précis of how to...
Probably a bit too detailed.
But... No, it's really good. I love it. But I do have a quick question for you. I wanted to come back to DCF and discounted cash flow, because that really is about forecasting the earnings as well, making sure you get future earnings, and then bringing those back to a net present value. Of course, you've got a discount rate in that process. Is, again, just asking the question, if you're using that methodology versus the capitalization methodology, the factors that affect the discount rate, just for the sake of completeness.
Similar to a cap rate, very similar. So if you are going to try and de-risk your business, it's going to work for you both ways. The only important thing around using a discounted cash flow is those budgets, you need to be getting close to those budgets each year for us to be able, because one of the first things we do is we test those budgets and see how good they are.
Yep. So really, if you've got a history of a forecast and then your actual measurables against your forecast, that would give you confidence in saying that the next forecast should be quite accurate too.
That would be brilliant. That would be fantastic. And if you're getting good at doing that, it's not only showing that your business is really stable, but there's planning moving forward. That would be fantastic. It's very rare that I find businesses like that.
So for all the clients in our Practice Max community, that is why I bang on about forecasts right there, okay? Right there. So for all the eye rolling that happens, there is a reason behind it.
It'll equate to numbers at the end of the day.
It's money in the pocket, right?
Absolutely. All right. Absolutely.
Hey, Jen, you've been incredibly generous. You've been incredibly detailed and meticulous as a forensic accountant would be, because for all of us who are a little detail-oriented, and dentists are at one end of the spectrum, I reckon forensic accountants are right there at that end of the spectrum with us. So I really appreciate the detail.
Well, I've given you a little bit, and I know I've spoken to you on many other occasions, and I know you sort of worry about whether I give too much IP away, and I've said to you, well, my staff can sit next to me for 3 years and still it comes down to a lot of experience knowing what elements to come out of this. And I've been doing this for almost 20 years and giving away my age here, but we have jam-packed a lot. I used to work 20-hour days, so we jam-packed a lot into that time period, and that's why I can stand up and call myself an expert in court on it. It gets very detailed, so I'd recommend anybody that is wanting to go through that, maybe have a chat to somebody who does it every day.
Yeah, absolutely. So for anyone who is thinking about either selling their business or maybe, and I hope not, I genuinely hope not, but anyone who might be going through some sort of matrimonial challenge or a partnership challenge and you need to get that value, I'd really commend Jenny and her website to you. Head across to jennyletz.com.au and you'll see all of Jenny's stuff there. Also, I'm going to point out the coolest branding in the world, because I love the ristretto and the cappuccino and all those sorts of things. And that's a whole conversation in itself right there, Jen, but we can do that another time.
Oh, where would we be without coffee?
Oh, it makes the world go round, Jenny. It is... Look, people say to me, don't you have a vice? And I go, yep, it's coffee. Coffee is my...
It is the nectar of the gods.
It really is.
It is.
It's the 100% natural replacement for sleep, don't you know? Anyway, Jen, thank you so much for taking your time out of your day to come and hang with us. I'm terrifically appreciative. And once again, head across to jennyletz.com.au and check out Jenny's stuff there, because there is a deluge of really good bits and pieces there, and I'd encourage you to check it out. Jen, thank you.
Oh, thank you so much, Jesse. It's been a pleasure.
Thanks, Tom. Hey guys, Jesse Green here again, and I really hope you've enjoyed the conversation with Jenny. What actually ended up happening when I was talking to Jenny about this material is we finished up the podcast and we just kept on chatting off air for a little while. And there's some really good things that Jenny shared, and she referred back to some of the material that we'd spoken about in the podcast. And it was so good, I just thought, look, we really should hit record on this. So Jenny and I did record just a little bit of a conversation of ourselves chatting away merrily. And I hope it is of use to you guys as well, because it really does add a little bit of special sauce, a little bit of seasoning, a little bit of the Colonel's seven, you know, magic herbs and spices, if you will, to the podcast episode. So, of course, I hope you find that really helpful. So here is just a few extra little outtakes that are here just for you. All right, take care. At our workshop, as I said, we are going to be doing this risk assessment, risk analysis, and I genuinely and honestly believe that people look at all the upside and forget the downside.
I guess you've got to be so careful with that. Look, as forensic accountants, accountants are naturally conservative. If you were to get your business valued by anybody within our industry, and a lot of accountants do business valuations, they just don't do them every day like myself. And they'll, rather than maybe see a lower element of risk, if they're not sure, they'll just go higher because it's safer for them and it's not going to hurt their insurance and everything else. So it's got to be really, you got to be really clear on that and try and keep that risk as low as possible. It's just going to come back in spades for you.
The profit is one thing. And of course, yes, drive revenue. And what's really fascinating to me, Jenny, is most of the guys, when you talk about dentistry and all this, they all focus on, I just need more clients, more patients, right? More patients, right? That will fix everything. And it's just not true. It just doesn't work that way.
No, I agree. You said it earlier. You said that you focus on the profitability first, and then you start to focus on the multiplier, so on these elements of risk. And it's something we didn't necessarily go through, but the profit, if you can get that stable and you can get that profit so that without having to move any of that, and then if you just start to work on the efficiencies of the business and start de-leveling the risk that you have in it without having to bring in more clients, without having to put on more staff, all of a sudden you might be able to take that business from a multiple of 2.5-3 to a multiple of 5.5-6. If you get good at it and you document all your processes and you have training in place and all these elements so people could step in easily, well, isn't that worthwhile when you haven't had to work harder to get more sales in and you're not having to deal with all the issues of team?
It's so worthwhile, Jen. But again, most people won't do it. Most people won't. And
It's a lot of work. Sometimes it's easier to say, oh, we'll just put on another staff member and we'll get more sales to fill that. But I think the amount of, well, is it really a lot of work? Because that's a lot of work too. Because, you know, to take a business from 1 million to 1.5 is a lot of work. And if, say, your profit on a $1 million business, say it's $200,000, just around numbers, if you could take that $200,000 and put it to $400,000, well, that's better than if you could take it to $300,000 with the 1.5. I'm jumping ahead of numbers here. Does that follow
through?
It does,
because you've basically worked on the multiplier.
Yeah, say if you're at 20% of profitability, but if you didn't increase the sales and increase your expenses and everything else, and you just worked on your multiple, maybe you doubled that, then that's a lot nicer. The other thing is you can duplicate that in other businesses.
Totally. Very, very interesting. The other point you just touched on a moment ago, which was stability of earnings growth.
Oh, please, if you can keep those steady, well, then that's going to make one of the things. When I see businesses and there are fluctuations in sales, there are fluctuations in gross profit, and in net profit. So sometimes I see businesses and there's 150,000 in profit, then we've got negative 90, then 120, then negative 70. You're just going, oh, this business is up and down. Well, that's a little bit risky.
Totally.
Yeah, whereas if you have all profit, there's no risk there.
So it's really funny. Years and years ago, I went to a course at the University of Sydney. There was a Professor Price running. I think his name was Price. and it was all about understanding how to value a company, how to value stock, basically. And he was talking about this one particular metric, which was Steger, stability of earnings growth. And I have to tell you, I think I did that course in the late 90s now, because it was before I was married, so I remember that's my reference in time. But in any event, that metric has stayed with me, and I think it's a really, really important metric, because he was mentioning, because he's a big fan of, you know, Berkshire Hathaway and a bit of a Buffett fan, and he was making mention that even though Warren Buffett hasn't expressly used that term, that in all the Berkshire papers that you read, stability of earnings growth is something that he really examines as well. So I thought, well, if it's good enough for Buffett, it's good enough for me.
Yeah, you said earlier that you focus on those elements, and I would really recommend focus on your profit first, try and get that steady, get that team running right, then start working on those systems and processes and getting those to devalue your risk level, which is going to increase that multiplier. But you need to do that with a fairly steady business.
Yeah, you've got to make sure that you're not kind of going hand to mouth.
Yeah, one foot in front of the other. Everyone gets there in the end.
Yes, indeed. Jen, thank you.
No worries. My pleasure.
Thank you for listening to the Savvy Dentist podcast with Dr. Jesse Green. For more free tools and resources, join the free Facebook group. Visit drjessegreen.com/Facebook. And for more episodes, visit drjessegreen.com/Savvy Dentist.